This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us today. This week, our Project Milwaukee series, The Currency of Water, has focused on the effort to establish Milwaukee as a world water hub, a place where industry, academia, and government coordinate to develop solutions to the looming water crisis that the country and the world face. Proponents also hope that such a collaboration could kickstart the Milwaukee economy and solve some of the immediate problems the city faces. Much of the plan is predicated on the hope that technology and engineering can provide the key solutions to the crisis. But Robert Glennon says they only represent part of the answer. Glennon is a professor of law and public policy at the University of Arizona and the author of the book Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. In the book, Glennon quantifies the water shortage that faces American cities in the desert Southwest and in places we think of as having abundant water and offers his blueprint to solve it. But Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke started by asking him a basic question, based on the water cycle lesson we all learned in high school. If all the water that has ever been on Earth is still here, in forms that are always changing, why do we have so much trouble accessing it? Where has it gone?
Well, the water's still there. It's a great question. But the water is not where we need it, when we need it, in the form that we need it. So take one example, and that would be every time a toilet is flushed in Los Angeles, as much as 6 gallons of water ends up in the Pacific Ocean. And that water will not be available until the hydrologic cycle that you described, Mitch, completes itself. And that could be decades or even a century or more out into the future. Moreover, what you get is you get a change in population, a migration pattern, and people are moving from where the water is in the United States to where the water isn't or where there isn't enough of it.
Well, and that's interesting because the settlement patterns of this country, of the world, have always been the reverse.
Yes. Water was always something that people went to. Villages and cities were always at the delta or at the junction of rivers, on rivers. Absolutely. And now you're seeing places like Las Vegas. And Phoenix actually was on a river, the Salt River. That was a big Native American base anywhere from 1100 AD on. But a place like Tucson, there was a river, but a very small river, not enough to support the population that we now have.
At one point, you write that what we need to do is no less than redefine the role of water in our society. The things we do with water aren't likely to change, though I guess having fountains in desert communities could go away. But most of the things that we do with water aren't going to change. So what's the broader message of what you're contending? What do you mean when you say that?
Well, I mean several things. First, we are spoiled in the United States. We wake up in the morning, we turn on the tap, and out comes as much water as we want for less than we pay for cell phone service or for cable television. So we are living under the illusion that water is infinite and inexhaustible. So we need to come to terms with that. Second, which is part of the first, we don't appreciate the value of water, and we need to price water appropriately. And third, we need to look at ways of taking water out of low-value uses and using that water for new high-value uses. Because there is, as your setup point made nicely, Mitch, no new supply of water. All the water there is.
Talk about the low-value, high-value paradigm. What do you mean when you're talking about low-value uses, and what are the high-value uses that we get more out of using water?
Sure. We grow a lot of alfalfa in the United States using irrigation water, not rainwater. Irrigation water, and often during the middle of the summer, in places like California's Central Valley, the Imperial Valley in Arizona. And it takes enormous amounts of water to produce alfalfa that has almost no nutrient value. The illustration I like to give is this. A ton of alfalfa sells for about $260 for an acre foot of water, which is 325,000 gallons. That will generate about $265 in value. That same acre foot used by Intel in making chips will generate chips that sell for $13 million. Now, it makes a lot of sense for the United States to ensure that homegrown, high-value companies like Intel have an adequate supply of water to keep producing their chips.
So when we talk about things like water innovation and ways of getting fresh water to places, we should also be talking about the prioritization of what that fresh water ought to be doing.
Sure. And what we haven't done in the United States, and what I argue for in Unquenchable, is that we need to be using price signals and market forces to let market factors weigh in for who wants new water. I think of it this way. our water supply is like a giant milkshake glass. And each demand for water is the equivalent of a straw in the glass. What the law in most states permits is a limitless number of straws in the same glass. It's just a recipe for disaster. So what we need to do is to say to anyone, whether it's a housing developer or Intel or a city or an environmental organization, if you want to put a new straw into the glass, you must persuade someone else to take their straw out.
We hear in this area a lot of discussion of turning Milwaukee into a hub for water research and innovation. What do you believe the innovative parts of a solution to the water crisis should be? Are we talking innovation equals technology or innovation equals attitude?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I don't know what the people in Milwaukee have in mind, and I wouldn't presume to dictate to you or to prescribe to you what you should do. But there's a lot of room for new technology, new uses of water, new efficient ways to use water. The problem right now, though, with that model, that economic model, is that the value of water is so low that there are all kinds of creative inventors out there with new machines, new devices, new efficiency tools, new ways to desalinize ocean water. But when the price of water is so low, none of these technologies are economically feasible.
You just mentioned desalinization, and there is always a great deal of discussion when you talk about applying technology to the water crisis about desalination. You write that it can play a limited role in the portfolio of some municipalities. What are the promises and the limitations of desalination?
Well, the promises are great because the promises are taking ocean water and making it drinkable. So that's just incredible. But the limitations are it's tough to do that. And the obstacles that desalination faces are first cost, because the membranes, the filters that we use to desalinate water, are very expensive, very high tech, very delicate, prone to fouling. They need frequent replacement. So that's a problem. Second problem is it's the energy used, which is enormous. And there is an intimate connection between water and energy that we have not recognized in the United States. So that's a problem. And the third problem is when you finish the process of desalinating water, you have concentrated all of the salt into a brine liquid, and you need to dispose of that. And that's a very thorny environmental problem.
You just mentioned the connection that you say we haven't made very well in this country between water and energy, and that's a significant issue, you write, in a place that grows a lot of corn, like Wisconsin, because of the increased ethanol production in this country. Can you connect the dots for us a little bit better? What is the linkage between the increase in ethanol production in this country and the water crisis in this country?
Well, in Wisconsin, it's not as severe a situation because you get so much rain. But in other nearby states, I don't know about Wisconsin, corn farmers are using some supplemental irrigation. So that's in addition to what Mother Nature provides naturally. Further west, of course, all corn is irrigated. And it takes a lot of water to grow corn. In fact, it's about, or it could be, as much as 2,500 gallons of water are needed to grow enough corn for 1 gallon of ethanol, which is stunning if you think about the fact that Congress in 2007 proclaimed that the U.S. should produce 36 billion gallons of ethanol by 2022.
At the heart of your blueprint for reform is the basic notion that water ought to cost more, that this is really something that hasn't been looked at on certainly a national scale at all. But it's not necessarily going to be an easy message for people to get their heads around, especially in an agricultural state, say, where farmers who use a lot of water are already operating with a small margin for error. How do you change the way we pay for water without having the effect of essentially telling people that they need to find a new line of work?
Sure. Well, first, let's be clear about a couple of things. In some cities, we don't pay for water. Absolutely nothing. There are no meters. There are no limits on what you use. You can just turn on the tap and let it run 24/7 for zero.
This is Sacramento, for example.
That's right. That's madness. In other places, there are meters and there are rates, but the rates are declining block rates, meaning the more you use, the less you pay for every additional unit. Well, that too is madness. So let's start from scratch. Let's recognize a human right to water for basic consumption, and then after that, begin to price water appropriately. Now, I have no intention of gouging farmers. Farmers have been using water in their business for generations, and they need to continue to do that to grow the crops that they're now growing. But it's the other kinds of uses that we need to focus on. And I would include farm uses in the West where the water is irrigated and provided by government projects through the Bureau of Reclamation, for example. Those projects are very much subsidized. It's not a free market. It's government subsidy. And that subsidy needs to decline in order to price water appropriately. And it goes back, Mitch, to what we were talking about a few minutes ago with respect to alfalfa. Because what we don't want is to use this very valuable resource to grow marginal crops like alfalfa in the desert in the middle of August.
Is it too late to completely solve this problem?
No, not at all. I'm very optimistic. Is there a crisis in the United States? You bet there is. But as I think I show clearly, we have many options to choose between and among. We can have a portfolio of solutions to the problem. What we need is the political will and the moral courage to act before the crisis turns into a catastrophe.
Do you think the regional approach of, say, the Great Lakes Compact is something other regions would be wise to emulate, or does it take away from the need to have a broader national strategy? Does it essentially pit the Great Lakes against other parts of the country?
No, I'm all in favor of that compact. That was a very sensible thing that was done, and I applaud the efforts. I mean, water is a local resource. I know there have been jokes about people in the Southwest wanting to divert water from the Great Lakes. And Governor Richardson from New Mexico suggested that last year. But the reality, Mitch, water's way too cheap. If water rivals the price of oil, if water becomes $3 a gallon, then we can talk about the Southwest coming to the Midwest for your water. But that's never going to happen.
It sounds like, if nothing else, water law will be a growth industry.
Well, it already is. And the problem is, you know, and of course I am a lawyer, is the disconnect between water and science. And the rules don't recognize that groundwater and surface water are connected. And we continue to let new straws be put into the glass when it makes no scientific sense to do so.
Do you feel like there needs to be a crisis for people to spur themselves to action? I mean, you write early on in this book about Atlanta and the surprise with which people who lived there kind of reacted to the fact that they were running out of water. But when it rains in Atlanta, when we go through a snowstorm in Milwaukee, when the rains come to Southern California, do people put this out of their mind, and does that make it that much harder to?
I have a diagram in the book called the hydro-illogical cycle, and it's a wonderful story of people getting their attention when there's a drought, and then forgetting all about it the first time it rains. So it's not an easy sell. People take water for granted, and we need to change that.
Well, Robert Glennon, thank you so much for spending some time with us and shedding some light on the subject.
Nice to be with you, Mitch.
Robert Glennon is the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of Arizona and the author of the book Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, published by Island Press. He spoke with Mitch Tyke. Glennon was in Milwaukee this week to speak at a forum at Marquette University. Tomorrow, our Project Milwaukee series concludes with the role academia is already playing in the water economy here. All of our Project Milwaukee segments are archived at wuwm.com.